Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Rob Burtman. I'm co-hosting today with another student loan consultant, Molly Lauder. Hi, Molly.
Hello.
Now, some people don't know that they probably call you Molly Laughter because your last name is spelled like laughter. I'm sure you get that quite a bit.
It is. It's actually Lauder, but I'll respond to laughter. So that works too.
Right. I learned that the hard way, just for those of you listening out there. Today, we're going to talk about whether to invest while you're in school. It's been a topic that we've been hearing a lot about. You know, obviously, Molly, we've heard a bunch in the news, the normal news cycle, about how popular investing is becoming. And the question is, should you be doing it during school or not? And if so, what are some of the pros and cons? And what are some of the better ways to go about that? So Molly and I are both CFA, CFPs. Molly is also a CSLP and MBA. So we're not just student loan schmoes. We are actually know what we're doing a little bit, hopefully. But I always have to put the disclaimer, although just that this is not considered financial advice, anything we're talking about today. This is not investment advice. This is not financial advice, but we will cover some ground in some of those areas. But you'll have to do what's best for your specific situation. Anyway, but before we dive into whether you should invest in while you're in school and how to do that, I thought we could talk about, we've been getting some listener questions. One specifically was from one of our followers, I think it was either from YouTube or Instagram, on, is there anything we can do during med school that can lower our student loans? So Molly, you want to tell us some of the things that you're thinking on what people can do?
Yes, absolutely. I always think about the background of a question like this, because, you know, what was this person really asking? And I think my opinion of it is, how do I walk out of med school, law school, even college with the lowest possible balance? So our general feeling is, and this is why we're here and why we do what we do, is that we don't want you to get caught up in that, believe it or not. There's a lot you can do in terms of payment methods and how you can pay off your loans once you're out. We generally believe that you need to focus on becoming a doctor, becoming a college graduate, becoming a lawyer, more so than what your balance is. If you get too connected to that, I mean, some people will need to pay off their full student loan balance, but we can talk about income-driven plans. We can talk about public service loan forgiveness. There's a lot of options we can do regardless of what your balance is. If we just want a plain vanilla answer to the question, I mean, if you have a job while you're in grad school or undergrad, you know, you can always try to pay some of the interest potentially, or, you know, working part-time, if it's possible, you know, in something like medical school, you could try to take fewer loans out in the first place. But again, I'm not sure that's the question underneath the question. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the best way to keep down med school loans is really, obviously, if you're in med school, you can't really side hustle while you're doing that because it's a full-time job. And the most important thing is to graduate and become a practicing physician. But the best things people can do to keep their student loans low, just kind of the direct answer to the question, is obviously school choice, right? There are some really expensive med schools, especially the private ones, maybe in the Caribbean. In-state medical schools tend to be the least expensive and provide just a fine education in most cases. So school choice, and then also cost of living while you're in school or while you're in med school, will matter. You know, obviously, if you go to NYU and you're living in Manhattan, you're going to take out a lot of student loans, not only for tuition, but to pay your rent and to get around the city and even just eat food, right? So school choice and lifestyle are the two biggest ones. But specifically for physicians, kind of like what you were saying, Molly, and I know it sounds controversial unless you've been listening to Student Loan Planner following us for a while, but, you know, especially for doctors who have the potential for PSLF, or at least low to mid six-figure incomes, depending on the specialty, paying back the loans is going to be fairly easy for doctors. I'd say doctors have the most flexibility of paying it back between either income-driven repayment, public service loan forgiveness, if they're going to work for a hospital, or if they're going to pay it back, they will usually have enough money in their income to pay it back. So kind of like what you were saying, Molly, it's totally weird to say it. I mean, I could tell you 5 years ago before I started working at Student Loan Planner, I never would have said this. But just like you were saying, Molly, it might not actually matter to keep the med school loans low, depending on your path forward.
Exactly. In general, you and I both are pretty anti-debt. So it's very strange to say that, but student loans are just a different beast.
Yeah, I remember when Travis, we met here in St. Louis in a co-working space, and Student Loan Planner was just starting out, and I was trying to grow my fledgling business. And he was explaining all this to me, and I'm like, there's no way that makes sense to like... that honestly, you can fit the debt around the lifestyle, your career path, and showed me the numbers. And I became a believer after some serious skepticism. Now, we don't want, obviously, we know student debt is an epidemic out there. It's a big problem for a lot of people, but just know that you do have ways to pay it back. So specific to this question, there are ways to keep it low, but there are also ways to pay it back on the other end. And just as a heads up, we do not only at Student Loan Planner, we not only have post-loan consults, like after you graduate, we can help you figure out the right repayment path, but we also have pre-debt consults where if you're about to start med school, we can help you figure out, you know, the best loans to pay back, what repayment might look like after you're through that. So you can just go to studentloanplanner.com and you'll have all the resources there to help you out with that. So thanks for the question. And yeah, we got a great YouTube channel going on. We're doing some Instagram stuff now. We've got the podcast. We've got our normal blog post email list. So we got a lot of different channels. So pick your favorite one and feel free to join us and follow us in any, whatever works best for you. Okay, moving on. So let's dive into the meat of this specific podcast, which is how to invest while you're in college or school, or should we be investing while we're in school? So let's just start off with a big picture view of when you Google investing while in college, I think there's over like 200 million results. So there's a lot of stuff going on out there. And obviously we're all hearing about Bitcoin millionaires, Tesla millionaires, Apple millionaires, people just throwing a little bit of money at something and all of a sudden they have more money than they know what to do with. So it's definitely on a lot of people's minds. So, but Molly, maybe you want to start us off on the conversation here?
Oh my gosh. I was at dinner just last night and I heard a story about, in a very, you know, official kind of, there was no joke in this person's voice. It was, yeah, well, my husband's friend knows this guy who invested when, you know, when Bitcoin was just starting out. He's been investing for 10, 12 years. So, you know, he's made millions, he's lost millions, but I mean, it's just been a really successful thing for him. And that's just, it's very interesting from someone with both of our backgrounds to hear stories like that really regularly, just at a dinner with friends. You know, this wasn't on CNBC. It wasn't on MSNBC. It's sort of become part of all of our lives, hearing about these massive gains that people have experienced in the investing world. And it's tempting, you know, that you want to get in and you want to get started with it. So that was my main point there. But we're hearing all kinds of stories like this. So if you are just starting out in school, maybe you have a little part-time job that doesn't distract too much from your studies, you know, how can you get involved? Should you get involved? Rob, you started investing in stocks while in college, right?
I did. Yeah, this was back in the late 90s. I was in college in the fall of 97 was my first year in college, and I graduated spring of 01. So my dad was really into investing, and this was during the tech bubble or the dot-com boom, right?
Similar to now.
It's very similar to now. I mean, everyone was investing, all these success stories. You see people buying fancy cars and just like talking about how they bought this stock and it went up 200%. And then they traded that, went into this other stock that went up 300%. So I was in college and started investing on my own. And I sort of realized that I thought I was a genius, right? Because here I am in college. I'm thinking, I don't need to worry about my studies. I can get whatever grades I want because I'm making a fortune trading stocks. I'm making much more money than the tuition costs for the school I'm going to. So my grades suffered big time. I thought I was a genius. And then of course, you know, halfway through college was when the bubble burst and I lost not only all the gains I had, but I lost most of the money I started with too. And it was a really kind of crazy time. I felt like such an idiot. You know, how did I let this happen to myself? It's kind of like gambler's remorse a little bit. And like I said, my grade suffered a little bit too. It's like all I wanted to do was trade stocks. And I was also in an acapella group at the time. And
wow.
So I like sing with the acapella group, trade stocks, worry about school later. Well, it's a couple of things I realized actually. Let me start with my realizations is that if someone is going to be investing while in school, they have to be super disciplined. I wish I was more disciplined. You have to put in a lot of time. Like if you're picking individual stocks or examining individual cryptocurrencies or whatever, what I now understand is that there are super duper smart people with billions of dollars and resources behind them. And they're on the other side of a lot of these trades I'm doing. So here I am in my college dorm room thinking I'm a genius with my internet access and my trading platform. But yet I was just a total amateur. But I think there are some benefits to starting investing early. I mean, this on the flip side, like this helped me launch into my career in securities analysis and investment analysis because I realized I'm an idiot. I don't know what I'm doing. I should probably learn about this a little bit deeper. And I love that investing has become so accessible to so many people these days. And I love that. But I think there's a lot of good that comes with it and a lot of bad that comes with it. So maybe with that in mind, maybe we'll jump into the pros and cons. So Molly, why don't you start off telling us some of the pros of investing while in school?
Yeah, the easiest thing, if anyone listening hasn't heard of compounding interest before, the reason why anybody you talk to about investing talks about your quote unquote time horizon is that the longer you're in the game, whether you're winning, losing, as long as you don't go to zero or negative numbers, then generally speaking, the market moves up and to the right. So if you're thinking about a chart, we're talking about a diagonal line that moves up and to the right, meaning it's gaining. You're making some money. And so a long time horizon, I mean, if you start at 18, you can do some really nerdy math and see what just saving, $1,000 a year or something from 18 to 68 and it getting a reasonable rate of return, it's amazing the amount of money that you can end up with getting started early. So the time is a no-brainer, but generally, I don't know if everyone listening has heard time horizon before, but that's why if you have the ability to save young, it just makes your future wealth leaps and bounds higher than it would have been if you start when you're 40 or 50 years old. Just like Rob, just like you were just talking about, you gain experience, and maybe you've invested $20 or $50 a month or $100 a week or whatever you're able to do. Well, if you lose that, it doesn't feel great, but you're also a little distracted with school. So you're not going to feel really horribly about it. And you're going to learn something every single time you make a mistake. You'll see that while everybody's saying on the internet that all you do is put money in and things go up, like AMC, the movie theater stock that was trading for a while, you might put it in and it immediately goes to zero. So, I mean, your own experience is really important there. It's a really exciting time to invest right now because of all of this news, as long as you keep it within the right perspective. I don't know, Rob, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, it is super exciting. I would say that going back to gaining experience when the stakes are low, meaning that it's better to take your lumps when you don't have a lot of money, when you don't have kids to take care of or a house or a mortgage. And where, like, if you lose it, it really disrupts not only your life, but those people that are dependent upon you, whether it's a spouse or kids or whatever, parents, even in some cases. Starting early too helps you realize your psychology. So there's a lot about behavioral finance and investment psychology, kind of like, sitting at the blackjack table and you're up $100. Do you keep going or do you pull your chips off the table? Or maybe you meant to lose $100 and now you're down 90 and you just lost 100. Do you put more money on the table and go deeper in, or do you try to claw your way back? So all this stuff is really important to learn because, as we know, market just doesn't go straight up. It has over the past couple of years, but in general, there's a lot of volatility. So if you can get in tune with your psychology of staying in the game during the peaks and valleys of the market and putting more when things are down and everything like that, if you can learn that while there's not a lot at stake, you'll be much more attuned to make more as your assets grow over time.
That's a great point. Just the behavioral aspects of investing, because everything that you just said, Rob, it really resonates. And I actually got an email about that this just today, is when it comes to building a portfolio or choosing what stocks you're interested in, what percentage you put of your portfolio you put in each stock or in each asset class is much less important than your ability to remain invested. Even in the worst times when you're worried the world is going to zero. I mean, if you want to make more money than your bank account or your savings account, which right now is basically nothing, you have to take the risk and learn how to take the risk. But in general, we hate downturns drastically more than we enjoy the upside. And so to learn that those downsides are just part of the game at a younger age is so important.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of I'm sure you know who Peter Lynch is. He's like a really famous investor who had one of the best track records in a mutual fund. This was going back probably 20 years at this point when he was at his peak. But over like a 20-year period or something like that, his fund had returned double-digit returns. But the average investor, because they had gotten out at the wrong time and gotten in too late with all the market volatility that happens over a long period of time, the average investor only earned like 3 or 4%.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So this guy knows. So even if you get out of the game at the wrong time or enter at the wrong time, instead of being systematic about investing, you're not going to make nearly as much as you would. And so, yeah, honing in with your own psychology on how you operate is really important.
It's actually really easy today to do that, do what's called dollar cost averaging, or just slowly get into the market with all of these different account types that you can open that you can connect to your bank and maybe send $20 a week or send something automatically. Maybe that helps you a little bit from, you know, selling everything and getting out. I don't know. I just thought about that. The link between your bank account and your investing account, if you can automate that, then maybe you can control your behavior a little bit more than, you know, just calling your advisor and telling them to sell everything. But that's another one of the pros here. It's so much easier to open an account and invest. You don't have to call three different financial advisors to buy three different mutual funds that cost you an arm and a leg anymore. I mean, there's so many easy ways to access, and we're going to talk about those a little bit later. There's not huge minimums anymore because of the competition amongst a lot of these companies. A lot of the trading fees don't exist that used to. I mean, it used to be, you know, $50 to $100 to buy a mutual fund or what's called a load, where you have to pay an advisor just to purchase something. So it's just amazing how efficient investing has become.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I first started investing, Schwab was kind of like the low cost broker, and it was still like $25 a trade.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was giving up a big percentage of my investments just to get in there, but I was making the money when the market was going up, that the transaction costs you minimal. But now you can invest, like you said, for free. You know, Schwab does free. You know, there's plenty of other things to do free. I even saw, you know, now you can buy crypto on Venmo and on Cash App. You can buy stocks on Cash App and crypto on Cash App now. So this is all in the long term. I think it's really, really great because it makes investing accessible. And, you know, they're kind of gamifying it too, a little bit too. But yeah, I'd say that's another pro of starting, kind of like what we were talking about before, is just that anyone can access it now. The cost is low. So if you do make some trades from a transaction standpoint, it's not going to be that costly. You don't have to have $500,000 of investable assets in order to start investing. So if you're in college, you can buy fractional shares. If you want to buy a piece of Amazon, you don't have to buy one share for thousands of dollars. You could buy, you know, a fraction of a share for $20. All this is great for the investor. So we've covered a lot of pros. So we got the long-term time horizon, getting experience while the stakes are low, just getting a part of the excitement and enthusiasm going around and learning about that. It's very inexpensive right now and easy to get into investing. Any other pros that you think we should hit on, Molly, or do you think we should jump to the cons?
Well, I think if there's anybody listening that the idea of buying individual stocks is scary or intimidating, or they don't want to get on the roller coaster that might be coming with stocks, you know, the advent of things like robo-advisors, they're very regularly talked about now, but, you know, having worked in the financial planning world for a while, robo-advisors, there was fear that they would take over financial advisors' jobs and things like that. But really what they are is they're designed for people who are just getting started investing and sort of want someone else to choose things for them that will get them invested in different parts of the market, but maybe they don't want to do the research or do all of the background. And a robo-advisor, you know, you'll answer some questions in order to design a portfolio for you, but they'll design it for you. So if you don't want to buy Tesla or you don't want to buy Apple, and that the whole idea of it is a little bit intimidating, a robo-advisor, which we'll touch a little bit more on later in the podcast, is a great option.
For sure. And I would say in terms of the pros, this is in taking advantage of that long-term time horizon. I love the idea of someone in school possibly starting off with robo-advising because it gets them a diversified portfolio. It'll be based upon their risk questionnaire that they fill out and like their comfortability, how comfortable they are with investing. And then they'll get have a diversified portfolio of different ETFs, global, you know, all over the place. And then they can just systematically invest. And that's probably, I would say, getting started the best way to do it, to do the bulk of investing if people have the money in school.
Exactly. It's like there's two different kinds. It's either you're doing this for total fun and just to get the experience. And that would be, you know, buy the stocks you've heard of or that sound interesting. Or if this is truly, even though it's weird to think of when you're 18 or in your 20s, this is money for my retirement, then a robo-advisor is probably, I mean, it's the easiest way to just get started investing like you would if you had $500,000 and go to a financial advisor.
Yeah, for sure. And you brought up another good point too, that, you know, if you're thinking about buying individual stocks too, if you're thinking about learning how to invest, the best thing to do is just start by owning a small piece of a company that you know well, whether it's, you know, everyone knows Amazon, right? When I do my budget consults through Family Budget Expert, pretty much everyone has a large allocation to Amazon. So just, you could buy a piece of their stock, you know, if they do well, then because of you and the billions of other people using them or millions of other people using them, then you participate. Or some people with kids, they like to own Disney because Disney has Marvel and Star Wars and Pixar, and they like to go to, you know, Disneyland. So sometimes when I talk about parents introducing their kids to investing, buy things that they actually like, know, and care about, and they can see that sometimes the news correlates with this, how the stock fluctuates, and sometimes it doesn't, you know, just kind of getting used to that kind of a thing. So that's great. But definitely robo-advisor, diversification, low fee investing, that's very prevalent and a very great way to get started with the bulk of it. Yeah. So let's move on to cons, right? So we've gone over the good stuff, the stuff that starting early is probably the most important thing, one of the most important things in there. Now, when we talk about the cons of investing while in school, wherever you want to start, Marla, what do you think is the cons you want to talk about?
I'm just looking at our list here, and I think it's kind of funny that we have more pros than cons. So you can tell we both like investing.
Right, but, that's a good point.
But kind of the no-brainer here is that college is really expensive. You know, grad school of any kind is really expensive. You also have to live, you have to eat, you have to get some books, whether they're used or new. So you might not feel like you have the money, and that's completely okay. I mean, you don't have to invest while you're in college. Yes, there are a lot of benefits, but you can certainly wait until you get your first bigger paycheck once you're done with school.
For sure.
I would say another one is, and this is what you already touched on, and I don't know if you want to say anything more, but it takes a lot of time. If you don't want to use something like a robo-advisor and you really want to look at the fundamentals of a stock, of why it's trading the way that it trades, for one, stocks don't always trade on the fundamentals or your understanding of the stock. You know, if you see a lot of people in front of Home Depot and you buy Home Depot stock, if people are lining up to do home projects, that doesn't mean the stock's going to trade. If you understand, you know, the intricacies of the company, it doesn't mean you're going to be successful when you buy it. So there's a lot of time and energy if you really want to dig into these companies, and that still might not even be enough to be successful.
No question. I mean, I did a lot of research when I was in college, but I wasn't doing the right kind of research. I was looking at the underlying numbers and the fundamentals and looking at the chart. What has the stock done? Like, what has the stock price done? But I didn't realize that stocks basically trade based upon not what's actually going on now, but the expectation of what's going to happen and for how long. And so the company could be doing well, but go down, or company could be doing poorly, but go up. Like airline stocks coming out of the pandemic. I mean, when we were right in the middle of the pandemic, travel stocks started rebounding, but business had not yet turned around and wouldn't turn around, at least still not turned around 12 months after, you know, the lows that we hit there. But yet they're trading at the highs before the pandemic even began. So that's kind of something to learn about. So you do have to devote a lot of time, because I guarantee there's tons of people out there that are devoting a lot of time to figuring this out. The other thing, and this is what one of the things I hit on with my story, was that it can become addicting. You know, I didn't have a cell phone back then because it was in the late 90s, right? But now with the phone in the palm of your hand, or like even on your watch, you can check your stock prices in the middle of class. You can check them in between classes. You can see how your portfolio is doing, or your, you know, all your investments are doing any moment in time, out to dinner with your friends, on a date. So it can become addicting. It can zap your productivity when it comes to school. I mean, the most important reason to go to school is to get the degree so that you can earn the wage that you're working hard for. So for the amount of money that you might be able to make with maybe the little amount that you're able to invest, if any, while in school, nothing will beat getting solid grades and earning that college degree or that graduate degree in terms of your future income prospects. So just don't make the mistakes that I made, I guess. Yeah. So those are some really big cons. If number one, coming up with the money in the first place, like you said, Molly. Number two is it takes a lot of time. It can become addicting and take away from school. Now, one other thing we do have to note is that student loans are not meant to be used for investments. So we really urge you, if you're thinking about it, to not use any proceeds from your loans in order to invest. That is not the intention of student loans. And that could get you into trouble if anyone finds out about that. So just be really, really careful about that. Any other cons that you think we should hit on?
Again, maybe we're not as good at the cons as we are at the pros, but I think that maybe we should jump into how do you do it? So if you're interested in investing, you maybe have a little bit of extra money. What's the first step? And we actually have a follower or a listener question here that is, should I be investing in a Roth IRA or stock investments while I'm in school? What kind of savings do I need? And that brings up a really interesting point that we haven't touched on today, which is, yes, so student loans are a big part of going to school, obviously. You know, managing a budget is incredibly important. And that's a portion we haven't really talked about. You know, there's some priorities that we feel you should set first before you start playing in the market. And some of these are maybe everybody listening here already knows these, but avoid credit card debt. I mean, if you can, you know, student loans are there to help you pay for school. but we don't want you getting out with $50,000 of credit card debt as well. That's such a higher interest rate debt and much more difficult to pay off while you're trying to balance a new job, maybe a new apartment or home, maybe a family, and your student loan payments. So avoid credit card debt if you can. In terms of savings before you start investing, if you can have a few months worth of savings, then that's what's called an emergency fund. And having, so for example, 3 months or up to about $10,000 of savings is sort of step two. So avoid the bad debt, then, you know, have some savings there. Do you need $10,000 of savings while you're in school? Maybe not. So could you peel a little bit of that off and invest it? Absolutely. But I think setting up those good habits early on is a great start before you start investing, because those will carry with you for the rest of your career and your life, really.
For sure. I mean, over time, the stock market has wildly underperformed credit card interest rates. So paying off credit card debt is always a number one. Plus, when people start getting comfortable with credit card debt, especially at a young age, it's sort of like the gateway drug into sort of financial instability is getting comfortable with credit card debt. We want to see you graduate credit card debt free with a little bit of money in the bank so you can move to wherever you need to move to get the job that you want to get, right? So you don't have to wait for that first paycheck or like go on credit card debt to bridge you until you get your first paycheck. So that's a number one. So let's assume that people don't have any credit card debt. They've got a little bit of cash and savings and, you know, they have a little bit of extra money. So there's a couple different accounts they can use, right? So there's the Roth IRA. There is a what's called a brokerage account, which if you think about a brokerage account, it's kind of like a savings account, but you can invest in it like you would like an IRA. So you can buy stocks, you can buy exchange traded funds, ETFs, mutual funds in there, but you can tap it anytime you want. It's a taxable account that you can put in as much as you want and take out as much as you want. You'll pay taxes if there are any gains and stuff like that. But what do you think, Molly, where should people start if they're in school? Should they start with a Roth or should they start with a brokerage account or another type of account?
One of the keys with when it comes to IRAs is that you technically need to have some form of income in order to save in either a Roth or a traditional IRA. So everybody loves a Roth. I love a Roth. That was the first thing that I saved in when I was in my early 20s is into a Roth because I had a job. I was out of college and was able to save that. Generally speaking, in order to save the $6,000 or so dollars that you can save a year, you should have some sort of offsetting income to compare to that. So if you're in med school, for example, and don't have a job, it's sort of an audit risk to save in a Roth IRA if you don't have income coming in of any kind. So a brokerage account is really easy. Those are the ones that are set up with all these different kinds of apps and things that are out. Like you mentioned, as far as taxes go, you know, if you happen to have a banner year where you invested $100 and it's worth $5,000 by the end of the year and you sell it, if it's under a year's worth of time, that's what's called a short-term capital gain, and you'll be taxed at your income tax rate. And so there are things that happen where I was talking to my hairdresser, actually, and he sold a bunch of Bitcoin and made $30,000, and he was so proud of that, but didn't know that there was a tax impact of that. And so when we're talking about a brokerage account, you got to worry about those kinds of things. I mean, again, you made a ton of money, so you're going to owe a tax bill on it. That's kind of the way it works. A Roth, you could actually buy and sell within a Roth without a tax impact because you're not actually taking the money out until you're 59 and a half, theoretically, unless it's for a couple of other purposes. But I would start with a Roth. It protects you from touching it in terms of taking the money out to spend, which is kind of nice. But a brokerage account is really easy. And hopefully everybody listening will make $30,000 on their Bitcoin trade. But for most of us, that's not the kind of gain we're looking at on an annual basis. So it's a really easy way to get started. I don't know if that answered the question. Rob, what do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, if you have any earned income, putting it into a Roth, it's not going to be taxed. So you can have that gain without it being taxed. And it's also protected, like you said, for long term. Now, Roth has different rules than like a normal traditional IRA in terms of when you can take it out and the penalties and fees associated with that. But for the most part, any money that you're putting into the Roth, you're kind of waiting until you're 60, which if you're in your 20s, that's a long time away. But again, with that long-term time horizon, you know, if you earn 7% on your investments on average, every 10 years, that doubles. So in 40 years, that's, let's see, 2X, 4X, 8X, 16X. So you can have 16 times what you put in if you get a 7% return for 40 years. You know, you put in 10,000, that becomes 160,000 extra that you wouldn't have had.
It's pretty incredible.
With the power of compounding. So yeah, if you have some money that a relative or family member gave to you that you want to put towards investing and you don't have credit card debt, then a brokerage account would be the way that you'd have to invest that. And in terms of where to go, the options are endless, right? You can go to Schwab, which has been around forever. There's Betterment. There's Robinhood. There's Cash App now. Like I said, you can now invest through that. I mean, the options are endless. Well, do you have any thoughts on what type of platform people should use to open up an account with? Like what place they should open up or what they should be looking for?
I think it depends on the person. If you want sort of the hype and the excitement, then Robinhood is the way to go. I mean, that's what we've all been hearing about in the news over the last several months. If you want something that's been around for a very long time and has a pretty good reputation, there's something called the Big Three, which is Schwab, TD Ameritrade, which has actually been purchased by Schwab, and Fidelity. So those are the companies that have the tenure behind them as far as trustworthiness and things like that. But I mean, Vanguard, Betterment, Vanguard's really not really newer, but I guess it's the fact that they've made it easier to invest for every person is a little bit newer. And then Betterment is definitely newer. It's one of the robo-advisors that we talked about earlier. I think it comes down to, do you want the hype? Do you want the reputation and the tenure that you have? Has it been around a long time? But really what it comes down to is you're going to be logging into this fairly regularly. What is the easiest for you to use and the easiest to understand?
I think that's a great point. I mean, it's kind of like any other type of advice. You know, what advice is the best advice? Well, it's the one that you'll stick to and the one that's going to work, you know? It's kind of like when people are budgeting, it's like, do I do the 80-20? Do I do the 50-30-20? Do I, you know, save 10% of my income? And, you know, how do I deal with my budget? The bottom line is, whatever system works for you is the one you should do. It's better to do something as opposed to doing nothing.
Absolutely.
If you want sort of tried and true, set it and forget it, you know, I'd say Schwab, Betterment, Vanguard are great. But if you do want that excitement, you know, Robinhood's obviously great. Cash App is now getting in the game. But just be careful with those, right? Because these platforms are designed to get you to look at the numbers often. And yes, we know that the more often people look at the numbers, unless they're professionals, even professionals fall prey to this, but you're going to end up maybe making decisions that might not be best for your long-term future with that. It's kind of like looking at the roulette wheel. I keep on using casino analogies, but it's kind of like looking at every single number of the roulette wheel before you decide whether you're going to bet on red or black, you know?
So don't quote me on this, but this is a bit of a dated study, but I think Fidelity does it pretty regularly. They did a study on what accounts did best or performed best of all of the accounts that they had. And the best performers were accounts where the account owner had passed away. So essentially, you know, in terms of thinking about checking your app all the time and, you know, on the other side, just setting it and forgetting it. Well, the set it and really forget it accounts were the ones that performed the best at Fidelity over the given time period that they studied. So,
wow, that's an amazing
stat. Helps. Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, over time, the market has gone up, but there have been periods where the market has done nothing. Okay. So from like 96 to 2000, the market went up 100% or something like that. Then from 2000 to 2003, it went down 50%. So it was right where it was at the beginning of the tech boom. Then it doubled again into the housing bubble in 2008. So you're back to where you were at the peak at the tech bubble. And then it fell back down 50%, you know, in 2009, which took you right before the tech bubble even started. So even though there were these huge run-ups and massive sell-offs, if someone had held their money over that 15-year period, then they would have broken even. But those who systematically invested in dollar cost averaged ended up drastically beating the market over that time because they're buying on the dips and they're buying less when the market goes up. So that's where the systematic investing comes in. So even if the market does stay flat, that systematic investing is going to be really important. But if you don't touch it and you have a big run or there's a big sell-off, you won't get in or out at the wrong time either. So, but that's a fascinating stat. I'd never heard that before, but I'm not surprised.
I know we need to find the official stat and share it through social media or something like that, the actual story. I wonder if they've continued with it because it was several years back that I read that. But
yeah, if someone finds that, if one of you out there listening finds that out, leave us a note. We'd love to hear from you and see that. I know, Molly, you've been hearing a lot about Acorns too. And is that a good place you think to invest? Or maybe you could explain a little bit of how Acorns work and if that would qualify as a good place to do this while in school.
I have been hearing a lot about Acorns, and my understanding, I don't personally use Acorns, but it's, you know, a bunch of savings accounts that banks did this several years back, and maybe they still do, where essentially if you go and you buy a latte at Starbucks, then these systems like Acorns will round up to the nearest dollar and put that in a savings account for you. And so I've actually been asked by a lot of clients recently, what do you think about Acorns? Generally speaking, I personally feel that I'd rather just do that in a savings account and not worry about investing that. I mean, you're talking about pennies over time, which absolutely add up. But ultimately, you know, I'd rather just have that in an accessible savings account, that roundup. It just, in my experience, seems to cause just yet another account that's open that you kind of forget about, you don't do anything about. And I'm sure there's a story out there about somebody that forgot about it and it did incredibly, or we'll definitely hear those stories in years to come. But I think that simplicity is really important, especially when you're in school. You know, and even when you get out, the fewer accounts you can have, the better. So I personally, I don't know, this is just my opinion, I'd rather choose something like a Schwab and just open one account that's a taxable brokerage account, maybe a Roth as well, and put money into those over time rather than having the auto draw. If I had an auto draw, which I had at one point when I used Bank of America, I think that's who had it back in the day, then I would just have that within my bank and keep it simple, not add yet another app that I have to, you know, log into and keep track of. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Acorns. I think everything you said, and then a couple other things, is that it kind of gives you the illusion like you're saving money, but you're really not. You're not saving enough for it to matter. I'd rather have a systematic, larger chunk of money that you know is going towards it on a regular basis. The other thing is that it's sort of like how credit card points and cash back rewards work on credit cards, where it sort of like incentivizes you to spend more money. You know, it's like, oh, I'll treat you today because I'm going to get an extra 25 cents when I round up. Meantime, you spent an extra $15 to get to save 25 cents. It doesn't make sense. But there's a reason that they do this, right? Because they want the more transactions, the more that they make in those transaction fees. And if you're thinking every time I spend, I save, people end up worse off because they end up spending more than the saving gets them to. So I would also shy away from that too. I'd rather go with one of the other ones we talked about. So now let's move on and talk a little bit about what types of things should people invest in. You know, we've talked a little bit about this already, but maybe we, you know, individual stocks, indexes, ETFs, crypto. How should people think about investment selection when they're in school?
This is contrary to what you did while you were in school, but I think, once again, simplicity is the best option. So whether that's a robo-advisor, you know, there are funds out there called target date funds or balanced funds. That is, it's one fund, or it's really hard to find a balanced fund ETF, I've found, but you could purchase a balanced fund mutual fund. And what that gives you is, for example, what might be called a 70-30 portfolio. So 70% of what you invest is invested in stock-like things, and 30% is invested in bond-like things. That's just one fund. So if you can find a way to do that without big trading fees attached, then to me, that's really attractive and really easy. But because of the time horizon, you know, another kind of anecdote, sort of like the Fidelity dead accounts anecdote, is that, you know, if we could all buy the S&P 500 at 18 years old, and hold it till we're 60 and just put our helmet on or our blindfold on and not look at it, the long-term return, there might be periods of 10 years where the return's low, but in general, you know, at 18 to 26, maybe even 30 years old, just buying something that matches the S&P 500 couldn't hurt either. To me, it's keep it simple, stupid. You know, try to make it as straightforward, unless you find this, you know, this is a passion of yours and you want to purchase the stocks that you're interested in.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I'm thankful for my experience of losing all my money in college, which is kind of weird. I can say that 20 years later, but at the moment it was horrible. But if you want to invest for long-term wealth, like if you're a FIRE person or like you really want to maximize and kind of build your wealth over time, totally agree. Use a robo-advisor or buy a target date fund. Just kind of keep it simple. Systematically invest over time, diversified portfolio. It'll grow on its own from 18 to 60, just like you said. If you are interested in dabbling a little bit in individual stuff, it's really tempting to go all in and say, I'm going to go all in on crypto and buy Tesla and buy GameStop and AMC and all these stocks. But history shows that that's actually, it seems like an easy way to make money in the short run, but it's a horrible way to make money in the long run. In fact, it's a great way to lose money in the long run. So I like the idea of sort of this blend of index and play kind of a thing. So take, I'd say probably 80%. I've increased the allocation over time because it's so easy to invest individual stocks now because you can buy fractional shares for no transaction fees. So 80% should go into something that's pretty stable, monthly withdrawals, you know, monthly contributions. Take 20% and honestly do whatever you want with it. Learn about the stuff you're interested in. Explore crypto if you're into that. You know, I won't go into my how I feel about the long-term prospects of it, whether it's good or bad. I won't do that. But if you're interested in it, just dabble a little bit, but you don't want to do it at the expense of your long-term retirement, because no one knows what's going to happen with any individual company in 20 years. I mean, Kodak was, no one listening to this podcast knows about Kodak, but they used to be like the company that you would invest in. They did film and cameras. And guess what? Digital came around in the early 2000s, late 90s, and they're wiped out, right? So even a solid, rock solid company like that can go belly up. You know, even solid bank stocks in the financial crisis went down. Some of them are gone for good. And auto companies have gone bankrupt. Airline companies have gone bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, that's a total wipeout. And with crypto, it's kind of in this exploratory phase where we don't know what's going to happen. So anyway, bottom line is definitely do the responsible thing and like the long-term wealth maximization thing of set it and forget it. But if you want to play a little bit, that's totally fine to do.
Just to summarize some of our biggest points here. So Rob, should you use proceeds from student loans to invest?
Absolutely not. If you go on like the application when you apply for student loans, that is not one of the acceptable uses for them. Nor is it for 529 plan proceeds if you're fortunate enough to have some of that stuff to go with you too. Only invest with money that it comes from another type of channel.
So if you're working in school, you've got a little bit of money left over, we feel good about that.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you get family gifts for graduation, you know, and you want to start dabbling with that, you can do that. I think all that's okay. I would actually encourage it. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's good to start early and just start messing around if it's something that you're interested in. But again, you know, as we know, getting your degree is much more valuable over the long run than, you know, sort of dabbling and investing while you're in school.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so we've talked, like, I guess you could talk a little bit about a hybrid between undergrad and graduate school that we've talked about so far. But, you know, I know that you had some interesting experiences with your investments that you had built up post grad school. So you want to tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I didn't start investing in college. So I didn't start in undergrad, but I was actually given a gift by a relative and I was working at the time. So I was able to put my $5,000 into a Roth IRA. And I happened to be working for a financial advisor at the time. So I thought it might be interesting to mention that even if you're not working for a financial planner at the time, you know, if your parents use one, they might be willing to take a look for you and help you on your first, if you wanted a financial planner. I think a robo-advisor is a great option as well. But I started with my $5,000. I said, what do I put this in? And it was a mixture of, I think, four or five mutual funds and one ETF. And believe it or not, I have not touched it. Mine is a dead person's account. but it's, you know, when it came to going back to school, so I was about 24 at the time. I went back to grad school for my MBA at 26. And one option would be to take some of that out and use it to help pay for school. So I think that's something that, you know, if you get started investing in college and then you decide to go to graduate school, you know, should you touch those accounts and take money out of those accounts? And I really think that's a personal decision. My now husband, but at the time we weren't dating, he kind of liquidated everything that he had saved 401k wise, Roth IRA wise to pay for education. And that's one of the allowable reasons to take money out of retirement accounts before you're 60 years old. You know, his loan balance was, there was a serious dent taken out by doing that. I elected to leave it and we ended up paying our loans off at the same time. So it's not something that I don't think we have like a direct piece of advice on which path you should take. I just personally valued the longer time horizon and keeping that money invested over getting rid of the debt. But I think just like every one of our consults, I think that's a personal decision of will it feel better to be out of debt or will it be feel better when you're 70 or 75 to have saved all that money. I don't know. That's really a personal decision, I think.
Have you and your husband kind of debriefed about how you would have done it differently or not looking back now?
We talked about it right when we got out of school and what we were going to do. And he collected some watches. He sold his watches. I mean, he would have, you know, I think sold the shirt off his back to be done with it. For me, that was a gift from a family member that even though I had the earned income and could have added the money to the Roth myself, I had a little bit of personal feelings about it. So I thought it was cool. I left my company after grad school to start my own business. So that put me behind. But for a while there, I was ahead of him in terms of my retirement savings. So I felt really good about that. It's good for competition, you know, but ultimately we did talk about it a little, but I think it was really individual drivers that helped, you know, make our decision for us.
Yeah. Well, that's nice that you had, both of you had the at least the ability to make the choice, right? Because you had invested early. And so you had the choice after grad school to say, should we do it or not? As opposed to not having started and not having that choice.
Absolutely.
So it's always better to have money left over and putting it away and have it grow. And then at least give yourself the choice of whether you want to be debt-free soon or whether you want to have investments grow over the long term and maximize your wealth over the long run.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's an interesting story for sure. So as we're wrapping up here, again, you know, we've talked a lot about investing in school. There's a number of different ways to do it. You know, one thing we didn't hit on just real quick would be socially responsible investing and ESG, environmental social governance investing. So if you do have that kind of bend, you can look up SRI investing or ESG investing. Those are some other options for you can explore. Probably 10 years ago, I wouldn't have mentioned that because most of the companies were not going to make it. You know, they were just sort of startups that, you know, were burning cash. But now I think there's enough out there that could be a good move for you if that's something that's interesting to you. So words of caution, if you plan to invest while you're in school, understand that this could become a little bit addicting or it could take your time away from that. Again, don't use any money from your student loans to invest. We're in sort of a really, really exciting time now. So don't let the excitement of this really unusual low volatility uprise market in all areas blind you to the fact that the market could go down at 50% or not. You know, we don't know, but just understand that that is a risk and you got to know how to deal with that. The other thing, like I said earlier on too, is that there's like tons of people with billions of dollars and resources and teams of analysts that are investing out there. And so their odds are in their favor to win versus the individual investor. So just, and I know like the GameStop, the Reddit, for one day they had their moment, but trust me, I think that's a short-lived thing in my mind, for better or worse, right? What do you think, Molly? What else should we leave people with as we're wrapping up here?
Yeah, I guess I'll just add to the end of my, or I guess it was the beginning of my story about my $5,000 that I was given. So it was a similar time. It was 07, 08. So it was right before the crash, which, not to say that a crash is coming. We have no idea if a crash is coming. But if it were, and you decide to put some money in, my $5,000 went to $2,500. I've told this story on another podcast episode, but my $5,000 went to $2,500 within the first couple of months. And I looked at the financial planner I was working for and said, "What? Get it out. Get it. I don't want it in there anymore. Never mind." And he was there to tell me, "You can take it out, but you won't get it back unless you reinvest it and wait." So I would not take it out. I would leave it there and it'll come back. And it's come back multiple fold, I think tenfold at this point. And so So as far as volatility goes, it is coming. It's always been part of the market. Again, that's just part of the game. So if you want to get started investing and then your investment goes from $20 to $10, I've been there and you'll survive. I guess that's my takeaway.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, especially when you're young, you can weather those kind of storms. That's not the kind of thing you want to happen when you're close to retirement. And obviously you would invest your investment allocation along there, but you can take risks now because you got a long time horizon. So I'm a big fan of investing early. I think it's really, really important. If you are interested in investing, we have a student loan planner soon is going to be launching its investment course. We've had this out for a couple of years now, and every year there's some improvements made to it. So there'll be, if you subscribe to the podcast or you're on our email list, you'll hear more about this investment course that we're going to be opening up in a little bit again. So just keep in mind for that so that you can learn how to do this even better while you're in school. Yeah. Any other final words to close out with here, Molly, before we leave our listeners here for the day?
Not necessarily. I think just when it comes to investing, especially investing in your late teens or your 20s, it should be fun. Don't feel like you have to do it if you don't want to. If things go down, try to think of it as play money. If you're 50, maybe don't think of it that way, but just try to have fun with investing. And if you're able to do it, it has incredible dividends, I guess, pun intended, later in your life.
For sure. And I guess one more thing I'll leave with too is that the best investors of all time, before they make an investment, they know their downside. Now, if you're just starting out, you might not know how to calculate that or what could happen, but just think about, what is the downside if I make this investment? We all know what the upside could be, especially in this market, but those who think about the downside can protect against it and usually end up better over the long run. So Thanks for joining us here on the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Molly, this has been great to talk through this with you. And listeners, if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.